To understand the Templars, one must begin where everything begins. The structure. Not the legend, not the mystery, not the image of the knight in a white cloak with a red cross galloping into battle. That comes later. The first step is understanding how the most sophisticated machinery the medieval world had seen up to that point was organized, an institution that combined the discipline of a regular army, the obedience of a monastic order, and the administrative efficiency of a modern state, centuries before that concept even existed. The order of the temple was not great by chance. It was great because someone designed it to be. The order was born in Jerusalem around 1119, in the chaotic years following the First Crusade, when a group of Frankish knights led by Hugues de Payns offered to protect pilgrimage routes in the Holy Land. King Baldwin II of Jerusalem granted them a wing of the royal palace, which stood over the ruins of the ancient Temple of Solomon, hence the name. Poor fellow soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon, or simply the Templars. In its early years, the order was little more than a company of men of goodwill with no written rule, no formal organization, and no clear resources. All of that would change radically in 1129, when the Council of Troyes granted them an official rule drafted under the influence of Bernard of Clairvaux, the most influential monk of his era and one of the most organized minds of the 12th century. From that moment on, the temple ceased to be an experiment and became a project. The rule that emerged from the Council of Troyes was not a vague spiritual text full of good intentions. It was an operational manual. It defined precisely who could enter the order, under what conditions, with what obligations, and under whose authority. Over time, this original rule would be expanded and supplemented by documents called the retreats, which regulated in meticulous detail aspects that the initial rule had not foreseen. How a brother should behave in battle, what happened if a Templar committed a serious offense, how goods captured from the enemy were distributed, and how the Grand Master was elected. What was built over the course of decades was, in essence, an institutional constitution of remarkable complexity for the era. At the apex of this entire structure stood the Grand Master. His authority was, in theory, almost absolute within the order. He was elected for life through a complex voting process involving a college of electors, and once in office, he concentrated in his person the diplomatic representation, supreme military command, and spiritual direction of the entire institution. However, it would be a mistake to portray him as a monarch without counterweights. The Templar rule was extraordinarily explicit on this matter. The Grand Master was required to consult the chapter before making major decisions. He could not declare war, sign an alliance, grant land, or dispose of the order's assets without the collective agreement of the highest-ranking brothers. This limitation was not a matter of protocol courtesy, it was a legal obligation within the internal regulations. In practice, the shrewdest Grand Masters knew how to maneuver within this framework with remarkable skill, but those who attempted to govern unilaterally encountered institutional resistance rather than blind obedience. Below the Grand Master, the first figure of importance was the Seneschal, who acted as his direct lieutenant and assumed provisional command of the order in the event that the Grand Master died or became incapacitated before a successor was elected. In modern terms, the Seneschal was akin to the Prime Minister of a parliamentary government. The executive administrator who kept the daily machinery running while the leader represented the institution to the outside world. It was a position of supreme trust, occupied by men who knew the order from the inside out in all its complexity. Alongside the Seneschal operated the Marshal, who was the military figure par excellence within the Templar hierarchy. If the Grand Master was the commander-in-chief, the Marshal was the field general. Directly responsible for organizing troops, coordinating squadrons in battle, overseeing the training of combatants, and managing weaponry and warhorses. This last responsibility was far more important than it might seem at first glance.